repeatedly said, and as Dr. Dupree had explained, his legendary trips to Europe were to steal European know-how, to lure specialists to Russia, to spy if a 6'7" man could spy on me, get away with it. Now, at that time, both nobles and non-nobles were Orthodox Christians, and for hundreds of years they lived together with the belief that to be Russian, regardless of one's bloodline, was to be Christian. Now, the westernizing influences ushered in by Peter the Great were inspired by ideas that were predominantly not Christian, enlightened, even atheist, and which coincided with the humanist philosophies in Europe, which rejected medieval Christian ideas. Peter was interested in restructuring the relation between church and state and making the church entirely part of the state. As we have talked about it up to now, there's always been a close relation between the two, but Peter wanted there to be no ambiguity in that relation. He gave land along the Nevsky Prospect for churches of every denomination to be built. So in effect, he reduced the Orthodox Church to an administrative state-serving body. As an enlightened despot, he was loved by those who loved the idea of Russian progress, hated by those whose lives were changed most by him. The Russian people hated Peter, as did the old aristocrats and the churchmen. His own son, Alexis, became Peter's enemy since he seemed a threat to the westernization process. The young man signed a document renouncing any right to the throne, but this was not enough to protect him. He ran away, was caught, brought back, and tortured, well, I think we were saying almost to death.
Yeah.
Six of one, half a dozen of the other, all had the same effect. Most symbolic, however, most dramatic, most memorable is his construction of Petersburg, and on this we've dwelt considerably, and yet not everything has been said. And Dostoevsky, you know, called St. Petersburg the most abstract and intentional city on earth, meaning that as a condemnation. The romantic ideal from Balzac on through the 19th century was for an organic city. Balzac's portraits of Paris were of this organic city that grew slowly on itself. It knew itself at all times. One had to know its ways and so forth. Right? Petersburg was the opposite. Was one dictated from the head of the great ruler and imposed upon the world, as it's often said, form, you know, brilliant, intelligent form is imposed upon the clay of inert matter, right? The opposite of any self-organizing or organic notion of matter. The island the original fortress was built on was uninhabited swampland, chosen for that reason. It was built on lowland, below sea level, all you lovers of New Orleans, take heed. Instead of being allowed to develop naturally on high ground, as settlements do, he wanted a clean break with the past. The founding of Petersburg ex nihilo seemed an intentional symbol, and it certainly worked out as an effective symbol for the new modern project discovered in the West, expressed best by Peter, as Russians always claim the ability to understand the West better than the West understands itself. A modern project of self-founding, of human self-founding, in which there would be no dependence on tradition or the past, and no limitation by material or existential conditions. Peter went about plotting the city with ruler in hand as a system of islands, canals, and broad, straight perspektivi, the Nevsky Prospect, over 3 miles long, an image of the idea that what the mind has designed and determined to be best, that is what will be done no matter the cost. To talk about cost, tens of thousands of serfs were herded there, right? No matter what their will was. They had no tools to work with, but they were commanded to build the city. They carried excavated dirt in their clothing. There was no housing or food for them. No provisions were made, and yet this was the task that must be done. They pounded wooden pilings into swampy ground. Several sources tell me that perhaps hundreds of thousands died there in the construction of the city, and no records were kept. This has become a Russian legend. It has become a Petersburg legend, a legacy of starvation, disease, and exhaustion. Karamzin, the court historian, wrote, "Petersburg is founded on tears and corpses." Piotrowski wrote, "Peter called his new capital his paradise, but it turned into a big cemetery for the people." The French architect who designed the general plan for the city was beaten by the Tsar and soon after died. I think Faulkner stole that detail for Thomas Sutpen in Absalom and Absalom. Peter ruled by decree. One decree said, "From this time on, all clamps and nails used on men's and women's shoes may no longer be sold, and no one may have any, just as no one, no matter his rank, may wear shoes or boots shod this way." There was a clamp and nail shortage. "And if someone does have shoes or boots shod this way, he will be fined harshly, and the merchants who keep such clamps and nails will be sent to hard labor and their property confiscated." Peter, I want to just get this notion across, is one of those rare figures who already, before the pen has come to paper, is already a mythopoeic figure, right? Who comes to mind as a parallel? Does Faust, does Prometheus, does Dr. Frankenstein, does it? Certainly Napoleon? And if you've been, you know, any sort of headline grabbers of the past 10 years, one would think of Saddam Hussein. And, you know, I'd at least say Vladimir Putin is a little easier to understand after understanding Peter the Great. The story of Peter the Great and his city is one that every literate modern ought to know, because he tells us in a peculiarly condensed, compelling, and therefore in a sense poetic way about our own times, about our own identity. Think of how Petersburg grasped the form of the modern city. Its population grew by the opening of an enormous work opportunity, being decreed by an act of will. It was geometric, not organic. It was self-founding, cutting its residents off from their roots in village family and the past. It was haunted inevitably with a counter-legend. Peter's first wife, Eudoxia, cursed the city, saying, "Sankt Peterburg will stand empty." A dread mythic creature was supposed to have hopped into the bell tower of Trinity Church. The masses nicknamed Peter the Antichrist Tsar. Complainers were brought before the dreaded secret chancellery, beaten mercilessly, burned with hot irons, broken on the rack, or had their tongues torn out. And still the legends grew, taking one form, the most poetic form, what you already know, the Bronze Horseman, which has been called the greatest poem in the Russian language. And it was, as you know, set during a flood of 1824. You know a little bit more about what might have caused that flood. Planning, right? Think of the brilliance of Pushkin, of having that statue as the major antagonist in the poem. In the crucial moment in the poem, and I'd love to see this portrayed in a movie or a cartoon or something, the statue wrenches its neck down and peers down with that. You've got to see a picture of the statue from the facial point of view, with these ominous eyes, and our poor young man who's lost his love of his life, and has gone mad in the meantime, and now comes shaking his fist at the statue, and the statue responds, yes.
Wait, were you saying Peter caused the flood on purpose, or that it was caused by poor planning?
Yeah, I sort of meant.
This is 100 years after Peter died.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, it certainly wasn't Peter on purpose, but Peter's, I think, attitude was, what the hell?
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, I mean, it wasn't a major concern.
Right.
Sorry if I get a little bit worried about floods in cities. Donald Fanger writes that in the poem, the tragic note has been discovered. That means the tragic note of modern Russian history, of the modern Russian city. He says, "The grandeur of the city, an idea and as reality, is upheld. But in its very origin, a hubris is recognized whose price repaid once by the thousands of workmen who perished in the first construction, continues to devolve on succeeding generations. So the mythic theme is carried out. Against the abstract grandeur is posed the concrete loss of humble lives. Against the public achievement, the private sacrifice. Thus the image of the city is doubled, no longer a passively heroic, it has become active and an antagonist as well. That split between public and private, between abstract and concrete, is the modern split, is the one that we quarrel over on a daily basis in our city councils, in our faculty offices, in whatever, wherever this may be. But it's one that Peter, as a provocateur, has brought about with his genius. So all of that makes Petersburg and its unpacking in the poetry that follows, notably the Bronze Horseman, so eminently worth knowing about, so revelatory about this birth of the modern world time that it's dealing with. Now, what happens to Petersburg in the meantime? Now, let's see if we can make a little bridge to Gogol's time, because we're leaving Peter behind in the early 18th century. Dr. Dupree's told us something about Catherine the Great and other monarchs that are intervening and of considerable importance. He told us about the Decembrist uprising in 1825. But as for Petersburg itself, the first decades of the 19th century were under the enlightened leadership of Emperor Alexander, and they inspired wonder and admiration in the literati. One poet wrote, "I must leave Petersburg. I must leave it for a bit. I must see the ancient capitals, old Paris, sooty London, in order to appreciate Petersburg's worth. Look, what unity, how all parts correspond to the whole." But by the 1820s, an important decade, a new impatience had come to rule. In the words of the Decembrists, they no longer believed in the good intentions of the government. Going to the heart of the matter, they declared, quote, and this is, I think, an important line here, "The world is beginning to learn that nations do not exist for czars, but czars for nations." Well, we couldn't have that. So that had to be stamped out. I don't mean to be utterly cynical. But this was, of course, 50 years after the American Revolution and the worldwide revolutions that came at the same time. There was certainly that current in Russia, and yet the decisive blow was always on the side of monarchy, of autarky, of the rule by the one, by the great one. So 1824, the flood, 1825, in Petersburg, the Decembrist uprising, where they marched boldly into Senate Square, the Square of the Bronze Horsemen, with weapons drawn to try to prevent Nicholas I from taking the throne. They fell quickly to the Tsar's artillery. One account recorded, "Between shots, you could hear blood streaming along the street, melting the snow and then freezing red on white." After the uprising, we mentioned that meeting between Pushkin and Tsar Nicholas, which is a very interesting thing. The sort of what's the term, portfolio that poets were still given in those days. For those days, Pushkin was called in for a private audience, and he later wrote about the Tsar, "How I would like to hate him, but what can I do? For what can I hate him?" Yes.
At this point, how unified is Russia?
Well, I mean, you know, the question is, how wealthy is Russia? And the wealthy parts were all, you know, under the control of a single powerful ruler. The other parts, who cares about? Right? It's really all kind of ambiguous in any case. Mm-hmm. Now, the church provided a longer-reaching network, but insofar as there was no wealth, there was no great impetus to rise up against. And there were clear lines drawn that we must defend ourselves against, various ethnic peoples who had designs on you know, sweeping over Russia with fire and sword. So I'd say it was, you know, it was considerably unified. Peter, again, was determined to bring Russia to the table as one of the world's great powers. So, the city, during this time, Nicholas' time, continued to grow and prosper. It was now approaching 500,000 in population. It filled with every kind of life and trade, watched over by an all-controlling police. Important detail for reading some of Gogol and Dostoevsky as well. The Severnaya Pchela, I can't say it, Pchela, the Northern Bee, was the popular newspaper of the time that circulated literary news, street gossip, news about crimes, fires, and floods. This is, again, something learned from the French, as the feuilleton of the French provided daily writing about the more poetic sides of city life. It would give, for instance, as a typical format would be to write about what happens at a certain cityscape at different times of the day, as if to naturalize the city, and again, make it seem like a place that had tone and character and so forth. This was picked up in Petersburg. Indeed, this is picked up by Gogol himself in a story that we're going to visit in just a minute, if we have time. The Northern Bee. Its editor was regulated by the police chief, who decreed theater, exhibitions, shopping mall, flea market, inns, pastry shops. That's your field. And don't take a single step beyond it. Only what is respectable and non-controversial may be published. Nonetheless, all right, a modern city with a modern literary membership and all bristling with ideas. Some of this iron hand that the Tsars ruled with is certainly an explanation for why Gogol was misunderstood as a writer and was considered a satirist, a social protester, and so forth, when in fact he was nothing of the sort. But I don't want to poach on dead souls too much. But to think about Gogol, you need to know a little bit about his background, his past. 1809 to 1852, born in the Ukraine, and so in a sense, more native to Kiev and its world than to the more modern Russia, especially foreign to this modern Russia developing. He came to Petersburg at the age of 19, determined to fulfill a vague but boundless ambition. This included various trials at becoming other things, included an attempt to be a lecturer at the university, there, where he was appointed to a position as a medieval historian about which he knew nothing. Gave a brilliant first lecture about generalities of world history, and either didn't show up or came with his jaw bandaged so that he could only mumble for future classes. it was a historic stint that he did at the university. At any rate, as one after another of his attempts crumbled, he came to hate Petersburg and to see it as inviting but hostile, alien and alienating. His father had been an amateur poet and playwright, descended from the Ukrainian Cossacks, a member of the petty gentry, but he died when Gogol was 15. Gogol was sent to a school of art and was introverted, self-conscious, and gifted in acting as a mimic, as a writer, and so a young modern in this regard, sensing himself as full of promise but not knowing about what. When he came to Petersburg, he won attention from the literary set with his stories and met Pushkin right away, his great ambition. That year, 1831, he brought out Evenings on a Farm near Dikanka, the first of his volumes of short stories. And those, his early writings, are about his Ukrainian upbringing, So they do not have this, the advanced wit and characteristics of his later writings. Although his sense of drollery and improbability seems to be with him always. He published two volumes of Evenings on a Farm near Dikanka, and then the next year, in 1835, two more volumes of stories called Mirgorod. So, two volumes, Evenings on a Farm near Dikanka, the second called Mirgorod, and two volumes of miscellaneous prose. The interesting stuff comes after these two volumes, which really are drawing on his life and his world in the Ukraine. Taras Bulba, a long story based on the history of the Cossacks, came from this time, and it's part of Mirgorod. But it was with the presentation of the Arabesques, later regrouped into a larger collection called the Petersburg Tales. I'm not sure whether that was done during his life or posthumously, but that he really began to display the true genius that we know in Gogol, his sense of the grotesque, his eye for the absurd in human behavior, and for that quality that we'll both be talking about a little bit, called poshlost. There has been also his play. It's called variously the Inspector General, or what's the other?
Revizor is the Russian.
Revizor, yeah. Right. The Inspector General. Again, which involves a massive case of fraud that someone gets away with. From 1836 to 1848, he left Petersburg, lived abroad, traveled throughout Germany and Switzerland, settled in Rome. Following Pushkin's death, Gogol dedicated himself to dead souls and recast his other works. 1842 was a banner year for Gogol, in which he published Dead Souls and The Overcoat, considered generally the best, greatest of his stories, and several others of his works were rewritten during that time. Dead Souls was a triumph. Critics lauded it for its satire against government bureaucracy. So in a sense, it was misunderstood. Gogol had other intentions, and we find out about them only later, as he is again away from Petersburg. And his consideration was that it was the first part of a Russian counterpart to the Divine Comedy. And he began work on a second volume in which, I don't want to steal your thunder, but it's just in general, Chichikov is converted to a life of virtue and proper behavior. And the only problem with the second volume is that from all our indications, he burned it, of course. So there's only some of it that's left. It's really not funny anymore. He's lost his wit. As he's become more earnest and more intent on the good life, he has become, you know, more serious and less himself. So it's a strange loss, but one needs to know of the overarching architecture that he had in mind all along, as we read Dead Souls itself. Yes.
You said he lived in Rome. Did he speak Italian, or just expect all the Italians to parlare Russo?
I'm betting that he spoke Italian.
Yeah, he spoke Italian.
he read most of European literature, and was influenced by.
There was also a large Russian exile community in Rome.
Really? Yeah. Even today?
They're all over Europe.
Okay.
And San Francisco.
Gogol's life ended sadly, more beyond sadly. He and related directly to this religious intensification that he experienced. He began to take instruction from an elder of the Russian church, ruined his health through various ascetic practices, fell into a depression, burned some of his works in 1852, later claimed that it was a practical joke played on him by the devil. Soon thereafter, he took to bed, refused all food, and died in great pain after 9 days. The sordid details of it are given at the very beginning of an important, at least in the history of Gogol studies, important book, Nikolai Gogol, by a novelist, Vladimir Nabokov, who was the first, really, to write about what the true spirit of Gogol was, and to correct the leading opinion of literary historians that either that Gogol was a realist, some called him the father of Russian realism, or that he was a conventional satirist. So Nabokov's views have generally been adopted by literary criticism, and so his book looms somewhat less important these days, but at the time it made a terrific readjustment of our understanding. Now, with his Art of the Grotesque, Gogol transformed his own personal disappointment in Petersburg into great art and channeled into it the entire wellspring of folk resentment and suspicion of Petersburg. The idea of the city, he wrote, is emptiness taken to the highest degree. Petersburg, he said, that ugly pile of fashions, parades, clerks, wild northern nights, specious glitter, and base colorlessness ruthlessly destroys the human soul. Mm-hmm.
So to what extent can we consider Dead Souls to be a satire? Obviously not to a great extent, but it just wouldn't be the main, I don't even know how to articulate this.
You're already impressing me well with the intelligence of the question, even if it's not entirely articulated. But I think I'm gonna defer on this.
Okay.
I think
I'll talk about this in a while.
I sense that this might go
or later.
Now, Gogol was. Let's see. We need to move on now. I want to read just a little bit from two of the arabesques that I think bear on our understanding of Gogol and his entire world of imagination. The first one is called Nevsky Prospect, okay, and it is really at the beginning a sketch rather than a story of Petersburg itself. Remembering that he holds also the belief that I just quoted him as despising Petersburg. You want to keep that in mind with the opening of Nevsky Prospect. There's nothing finer than Nevsky Prospect, not in Petersburg anyway. It is the making of the city. What splendor does it lack, that fairest of our city thoroughfares? I know that not one of the poor clerks that live there would trade Nevsky Prospect for all the blessings of the world. Not only the young man of 25 summers with a fine mustache and a splendidly cut coat, but even the veteran with white hair sprouting on his chin and a head as smooth as a silver dish, is enthusiastic over Nevsky Prospect. And the ladies. Nevsky Prospect is even more attractive to the ladies, and indeed, to whom is it not attractive? And he goes on in this vein. All-powerful Nevsky Prospect, sole place of entertainment for the poor man in Petersburg. How wonderfully clean are its surfaces, and my God, how many feet leave their traces on it. The clumsy, dirty boots of the ex-soldier under whose weight the very granite seems to crack, and the miniature, ethereal little shoes of the young lady who turns her head toward the glittering shop windows as the sunflower turns to the sun, and the rattling saber of the ambitious lieutenant, which marks a sharp scratch along it, all print the scars of strength or weakness on it. What changes pass over it in a single day? What transformation it goes through between one dawn and the next? And on he goes in this vein, right? It's an encomium. Right, and one begins, as one often does in Gogol, to suspect just how sincere It is, but at the same time, there's a fascination not only with the object, but with one's own rhetoric about the object. You know, it becomes a, well, he says, and the ladies' sleeves that you meet on Nevsky Prospect. Ah, how exquisite. They're like two balloons, and the lady might suddenly float up into the air, were she not held down by the gentleman accompanying her. For it would be as easy and agreeable for a lady to be lifted into the air as for a glass of champagne to be lifted to the lips. Okay. On he goes. A story is woven. The story itself can't match the brilliance of this opening. It's a kind of ordinary story. One young man has a terrible disappointment in love, and the other is more of a scoundrel and gets away with a beating. But at the end, the tone has changed somewhat as he comes back to that level of overview of Petersburg. And he says, but strangest of all are the incidents that take place on Nevsky Prospect. Oh, do not trust that Nevsky Prospect. I always wrap myself more closely in my cloak when I pass along it and try not to look at the objects which meet me. Everything is a cheat. Everything is a dream. Everything is other than it seems. You think that the gentleman who walks along in a splendidly cut coat is very wealthy? Not at all. All his wealth lies in his coat. And so forth. It goes on. But lady, you imagine those ladies? But ladies are least of all to be trusted. So, big change. And just in the arc of this story. Do not look into the shop windows. The trifles exhibited in them are delightful, but they have an odor of money about them. And then on he goes. Keep your distance, for God's sake, keep your distance from the street lamp. And pass by it quickly as you can. It is a happy escape if you get off with nothing worse than some of the stinking oil on your foppish coat. Your foppish coat. But even apart from the street lamp, everything breathes deception. It deceives at all hours, the Nevsky Prospect does, but most of all, when night falls in masses of shadow on it, throwing into relief the white and dun-colored walls of the houses, when all the town is transformed into noise and brilliance, when myriads of carriages roll off bridges, postilions shout and jump up on their horses, and when the devil himself lights the street lamps to show everything in false colors. The end. You think that's good? Now, there's a story that it's been said no one should graduate from college without having read. And the hero of this story has a statue dedicated to it, at a certain plaza in Petersburg. This is the nose. All right. The story begins with a barber at home slicing into a loaf of bread and finding a nose in the middle of it. He's seized with guilt immediately. It's as though it's rather, you know, doesn't know why. And a sense that somehow he must dispose of it somehow. You know, it's evidence for what it's not clear. His wife berates him, "You scoundrel! I told you your razor would slip one of these days and this would happen." He wraps it up and takes it into the city, takes it to a bridge, tosses it off the bridge, trying to look as inconspicuous as possible, but a policeman has seen him. At that point, Gogol shifts the scene. And Gogol says, very disingenuously, but nothing is known of what happened next. Yeah. No. I think it is known what the policeman had done to him. So, cut to the next scene. One Kovalyov awakes to find in the middle of his face, instead of his nose, a completely smooth space. His anxiety, however, concerns not the total absurdity of this, but his loss of face among his peers and his superiors, because he is, in fact, a bureaucrat who has scraped and clawed his way to the comparatively meager rank of collegiate assessor. And he doesn't want that threatened. So he's wild with anxiety, but not because of the absurdity of the universe, because I must get my nose back, right? He determines to hunt it down and to get it back. And so we cut to another scene in which he's there, and he sees, almost out of the corner of his eye, a mysterious figure getting off the carriage in a forget where, downtown in Petersburg. And, you know, it's dressed very, very, dressed to the nines in a great coat, a plume, you know, all these details. And of course, it's his nose. And lo and behold, you know, his nose now has more dignity than Kovalyov and claims when Cross interviewed to hold a higher rank, the rank of civil counselor. So he wears a gold braided uniform and sports a sword. So it looks, shouts, frowns, and smiles, and indeed seems more expressive than Kovalyov himself. The nose hiding his face completely in his large stand up collar and entering Kazan Cathedral and praying with an expression of the utmost piety. If you can imagine a nose doing that. Kovalyov is utterly at a loss and can only splutter, but you are my own nose. It seems, you know, and you've got to read it. It's a wonderful story. The nose loses none of its dignity. However, it's soon vanished, it's gone away. And Kovalyov is left with this problem of what to do. In part, it begins to seem like an escaped servant or an escaped serf. He goes to the newspaper and wants to put out an ad for a missing nose. They won't let him run the ad. You know, I'm sorry, but I think various ways of construing what he's saying, but you know, all of them don't quite get it. But they're not interested in the absurdity of the problem. They're interested in. Having a respectable newspaper, and a respectable newspaper doesn't print such things. And eventually, he gives up and is in a depression and gets a knock on the door, and I believe it's a policeman who comes to him and says that we found your nose. It finally showed up at the border where it was trying to pass off a false passport and escape the country. And at first, we believed its story, but then I realized, hey, it's a nose. Kovalyov is overjoyed. He resumes his life promenading about on Nevsky Prospect as though nothing had happened. The phrase "why is unknown," "Neizvestno pochemu," "why is unknown," is repeated several times in the story. And the last sentence of the story is, "But what is strangest, what is most incomprehensible of all, is that authors can choose such subjects." I confess that is quite unfathomable. I simply don't know what to make of it. Okay. I just thought you had to have a taste of these great short works.
And I'll ask you to do us a favor and check on Blackboard and make sure you're registered, okay, so that you can get onto the course on Blackboard, because under course documents, it's a copy with facing the Russian original with facing translation in English of the nose, mm-hmm. among other things, including two translations of the Bronze Horseman and a few other things. Oh, can I borrow that from you?
Oh, yeah.
For a second. And I'll give it back. Well, let's tackle this question of satire. Gogol understood by contemporaries to be a satirist in some cases, but that's a very inadequate description of what he does. In fact, I would say satire is not really at the center of what he does, but something else. Now, what I want to do this time, I won't say too much about the text of Dead Souls, because I want to place it not only in the context of Gogol's other works, but in the context of this remarkable flowering, suddenly, of the Russian novel. And Dostoevsky was supposed to have said, although it's probably apocryphal, that we all came out from under Gogol's overcoat, which is another fantastic story of sorts. Gogol was no stranger to fantastic stories. He wrote a number of them in his earlier tales. There's a tale called V, which is about a kind of monstrous creature who swallows up a theology student, or a philosophy student, actually, who has encountered a witch who was in the guise, who was really a transformed, beautiful young woman, and all of these strange things. But he discovered something else, and he placed himself in dead souls, especially, in a long line of literary works that I won't go into in detail because it takes me a whole semester to get anybody to understand what this is. I won't even say very much in definition of Menippean satire, but I want to speak of somewhat beyond and within that tradition. All right, we have to bear in mind, first of all, that one of the most important things that happened in this period of the 20s and 30s, especially in the 30s, was the emergence of criticism, literary criticism, which played an enormous role in the subsequent development of Russian literature. That is to say, it was criticism then, mostly liberal criticism, and mostly criticism that looked for this positive hero that we noticed last time. It was criticism that then demanded higher standards in literature and shaped the future of Russian literature for the rest of the century and beyond. What it did was to make Russians and Russian writers reflect on literature itself in a new way. What was the meaning of literature? What is its role in society? What is its raison d'être? And especially in the figure of a young critic, very influential, who praised Pushkin and who wrote an important early article, several early articles on Gogol himself, and sort of made his reputation. This is Belinsky, who also somewhat championed the young Dostoevsky, so in the 30s and 40s. The Decembrist changed the role of the writer. So what happened here, thank you, what happened with the Decembrist was that they then gave rise to a kind of new sort of writer who is political, but not in the usual sense, not in the overt sense. And Gogol and Pushkin both, in a way, belong to this new kind of writer. He's a writer who's both a nationalist on the one hand, and yet a critic. He's a writer who seeks to encompass a greater whole than writers had in the past. He's a writer who's capable of learning from Western Europe, but bringing to it something, bringing to the Western model something totally original and utterly Russian. But in the midst of all of this is, of course, the very same censorship and the very same oppression that we've been talking about. And the title, Dead Souls, to begin with, caused problems with the censors. This is Gogol himself talking about the committee that he had to present his manuscript to. Someone suddenly got Snirgyrev all twisted around, and I discovered he is presenting my manuscript to the committee. The committee is receiving it as if the issue had been decided in advance, and all that remains now is to play out the comedy. For all the charges, without exception, were comic to the highest degree. So the body of censors he sees as farcical and comic, straight out of the Inspector General. And we'll find this is very, very germane to what Gogol does.
As soon as Golovastov, who was presiding, heard the title Dead Souls, he bellowed in stentorian tones, "No! This I will never permit. The soul is immortal. The author is taking up arms against immortality." They were finally able to get it through the wise chairman's head that the souls in question were revisionary souls, serfs. When he and all his fellow censors had finally come to understand this point, there arose almost immediately a still bigger fuss, because the Russian word dushi can be translated either as soul or as serf, you see. And of course, Gogol means it in both senses, although he believed in the immortality of the soul. No, cried the chairman, and in his wake, half of his colleagues. The thing would be inadmissible, even if only the term revisionary souls were involved. This certainly cannot be passed. It is clearly against the institution of serfdom. So you see, in the wake of the Decembrists now, even this comical title has sinister overtones. It's subversive. And so Gogol, of course, had to defend his manuscript. And like Pushkin, he had to make certain excisions and revisions in it before it could be published. And so he answered, "With reference to deliberations concerning the instructions with which your honor has furnished me, I have the honor herewith to inform you," that's the language, "as regards the subject, one, in the very request of Chichikov, Pavel Ivanovich, the honorable collegiate assessor, there is evident a misapprehension. This in the fact that the revisionary souls are referred to there most imprudently as dead. By this, evidently, it is meant that these souls are close to death or dying, not that they are in fact deceased. What is more, such a term as dead souls points to a sort of superficial erudition, probably limited by the instruction of a parish grammar school, since the soul is immortal." Well, all right. So, Gogol was praised by Belinsky as a realist. And now we have to ask ourselves what that means. What is a realist? What is real? As you can gather already from the nose, maybe realist is not the most appropriate title to grace Gogol's work with. In what sense is he a realist? Well, let's look at the realistic novel as it had developed by this time in the 19th century. What is the realistic method? The realistic method is, you might say, a shift in perspective. It's a shift in perspective that brings into the world of literature certain aspects of society that were, in the past, not deemed important enough to mention. In one sense, realism means a greater inclusiveness. And it was Gogol himself who said that his Dead Souls was about all of Russia, by which he meant, I think, not all of geographical Russia, but all the aspects of Russia, all the social classes that make up Russia, all the types, all of the characters. When he read the first draft of it to Pushkin, who recognized his genius very early and encouraged him, and as editor of a number of literary journals, published him, Pushkin listened to it, and his response was, "How dreary is our Russia." He really, it's sometimes translated, "How sad is our Russia." And Gogol was a little taken aback. He hadn't meant to make the novel seem depressing. And he certainly hadn't meant it to be quite satirical in that sense. So what was he doing? Well, Bielinski and his school, his associates, were interested, on the one hand, in nationalism, in Russia. But they were progressives. And as progressives, they believed that realism then meant showing Russia as it is, in its future greatness, as a place with a great deal of potential, but also facing the not so unpleasant aspects of the present. And for them, Gogol, as satirist, then was a critic of those aspects of Russia that were somewhat lacking in perfection. Gogol, however, came from the tradition of folklore, Ukrainian folklore specifically, but there's a great deal of Russian folklore too. And so his approach then is both from the top down and the bottom up. And it's this bottom up that even a Pushkin didn't manage. Pushkin was in some ways a kind of classicist. He was an aristocrat. Pushkin was acceptable because, as a matter of fact, he was a person of the upper classes. Now, by the way, the Russians view Pushkin as their Shakespeare, the man who sort of set Russian literature on the path of greatness, and their greatest poet. Well, what is realism? Now, I'm going to give you a definition of realism that's not the usual one. Realism resides not in the expected, not in the commonplace, not even in the drab or the dreary. It resides in the unexpected. Now, let me explain what I mean. Art is built on conventions of representation. And you see Gogol playing with these marvelously in chapter one. He describes an inn. And what does the inn look like? Every inn you've ever seen. The walls had the same sooty marks up at the top. The walls in the same sort of ochre paint. And you go into the dining room, it's the same samovar that you've seen in every inn, and so on and so forth. You've seen all this before. Well, that's not what constitutes realism. Now, suppose you're a novelist, and you were describing this room in such a way that it was distinct from every other room you've ever been in. What would you do? Would you say, the room had four walls, a ceiling, and a floor. There were two doors in the back, and there were corridor-like entrances on the sides, and there was a glass wall in the back. You can think of many rooms like this. What does a realist do? A realist will say, on the left wall, there was a chalk mark about 5 feet from the floor with a sort of squiggle at the end. What you choose is the unexpected detail, the thing you've never seen before. You don't notice. You don't look at it. Why? Because it's not important. It's not part of the generalizable universe. In this sense, Gogol is certainly a realist, but he goes beyond realism because what he makes us aware of is the very conventionality of almost everything we perceive and do. Everything is folded into patterns. Gogol on the human face. Now, this will not surprise you very much after you've heard about the nose. And really, Gogol says, what sorts of faces aren't there on this earth? No matter what mug you pick, none are alike. The nose is the commanding presence on the face of one. For another, it's the lips. For a third, it's cheeks, which has so enlarged their domain as to make even the nose look no bigger than a vest button. Another has such a large chin that he has to keep it covered with a handkerchief to keep from spitting on it. And how many there are who do not look like people at all? This one is a perfect dog dressed up in tails, such that you're surprised to see him carrying a walking stick. It looks like the first person he meets would snatch it away. So this is the Gogolian take on the face, on people. And it moves towards what is very often described as the grotesque. Now, we'll speak a little more about the grotesque next time, because if I got onto this subject, we wouldn't even make it to 7 o'clock. So what Gogol does then is call attention, first of all, to the fictionality of fiction. He's certainly not the first to do this, but he does so in a way that is, first of all, unique, or at least for his time in Russian literature, and it was so striking. But also, he does it in such a way as to give birth later to such movements as the Latin American notion of magical realism, too. But a colleague of Dr. Cowan's has written an article on this in Gogol, as a matter of fact, so I can refer it to you, but I won't go any further with it. Narrative structure.
I'm just curious, was Gogol's work accessible to the West early on, or was it only...
Fairly early, yes.
Okay.
But it wasn't very well translated. By the second half of the 19th century, it was, but in not very faithful, and certainly in terms of tone and style, not very good translations. Well, what is the fictionality of fiction? Now, this is a theme that we get in a book that Gogol knew very well. In fact, it was Pushkin himself who encouraged Gogol to look at the form of this particular book, and that's Don Quixote. And as you know, Don Quixote is about a man who decides that life ought to be like fictions that he's read, specifically chivalric romances. And what Quixote does is to try to act out the plots of chivalric romances in real life. And this has opened up a very large question that gets back to the business of literary criticism and theory, which is the role that literature actually plays in our lives. Is literature supposed to give us a positive hero, a model, someone that gives us a pattern for action, who builds the plots of our lives? Or does it do something else? Does it work indirectly? Does it work by analogy? Or does it work by doing something devious and maybe the very opposite of what we're supposed to do? Does it show us the wrong way and the right way? Or does it show us ways that we've never thought about? Well, this is what Gogol is about. Now, we might distinguish here between two different strategies. One we'll call story, and the other we'll call episode. All right, so a story has a beginning, middle, and an end. It also has a direction. An episode is an event that may be interesting, may be funny, may be tragic, sad, but that doesn't have any particular larger context. So you can have two kinds of stories. You can have a story in which you move necessarily from one stage to the next, from the beginning through an enchained series of middle events to a final result of all of this. In tragedy, it's inevitable. Or you can have a string of episodes bound together by who knows what. Imagine a very large umbrella, and it starts raining. And a lot of people start gathering under the umbrella.
And also a few other things. A bird flies in, cats, dogs, a very discomfited rat creeps in among the feet of the people huddling together. What do they all have together? They all have together a dislike of getting wet. So they're like episodes. And the organizing principle here is the umbrella, which in a sort of negative way gives them all something in common suddenly. We see what they have in common under the umbrella. They don't want to get wet. This is the Gogolian pattern, and that of many others. Little wonder that Gogol had such a hard time transforming the story of Chichikov into the three volumes of a Divine Comedy. Because what he's showing us is the fictionality of the universe, at least in this book, and he is calling attention to the fact that we construct episodes into an umbrella structure somehow, but we don't necessarily connect them in a causal sequence as we do in a story. Now, what is the larger umbrella for Gogol? Well, ultimately, it's mankind. It's mankind and mankind's flaws. And Gogol wants mankind to be better. But he's not really sure why mankind isn't better. But there is another umbrella, somewhat less extensive, and that umbrella is what the Russian critic Mikhail Bakhtin calls a chronotope. That is a combination or a specificity of space and time that characterizes a given story or a literary work. So it's the character of the space and the character of the time, and not just the historical and geographical limitations. Right? The chronotope here is modern Russia. Russia in the 19th century, emerging into a major power, but also at odds with itself in many ways. So there is the fictionality of fiction, but now we have to recognize what I would call the conventionality of social existence as well. In other words, society is the umbrella, and it draws us together, and very often what we have in common is not a great deal other than survival. And so we create societies in order to survive. Conventionality. We come with one another. And social existence then is also built on fictions. And this is what Gogol's Dead Souls is all about. Every one of the landowner characters he meets lives according to a fiction that is both imposed on him or her by society, by other people. And this has to do with ranks, it has to do with social class, but it also has to do with the nose on your face, it has to do with the way you dress, it has to do with your overcoat, it has to do with your nose, it has to do with the street you live on, it has to do with how much money you make, it has to do with the prestige you gain from what you do or the prestige you think you have, it has to do with what you think of yourself, which is also a fiction, it has to do with the story that you tell of your own life. What's fascinating about Chichikov is that he is, you might say, the opposite of a realistic character. So if you look at the opening, the famous opening, the carriage that Chichikov arrives in is more conspicuous than Chichikov, even though we're told that it's the kind of carriage favored by bachelors, retired lieutenant colonels, second captains, landowners possessing 100 souls or so of serfs, in a word, all those that are called the fair to middling sort. The people who have no particular characteristics about them at all, this
carriage, then is the sort of thing they prefer. So it's a kind of metonymy. It sort of stands for all of these people. He's somebody who's nobody in particular. Somebody who's nobody. And it's this nobodiness, dead souls, right? Nobodiness, then that characterizes all these characters. His arrival created no stir whatever. The gentleman seated in his carriage was not handsome, but he wasn't bad to look at either. He was neither too stout or too thin. You couldn't say he was old, but still, he wasn't what you might call any too young either. All right. Now, what Gogol saw was that reality is constantly romanticized. Now, remember, the word roman in the Latin languages and in other languages which borrowed from him, the word roman is the word that's usually translated in English as novel. Where did roman come from? It came from the Romance languages in which these medieval stories were written, and they were stories that were not like the stories by classical authors. They weren't epics, they weren't tragedies, they were romances. They had a large element of the fantastic about them. They were written not in Latin, but in the vulgar or vernacular languages. By the way, they were not necessarily popular literature, at least not in the Middle Ages. They were part of the court literature, they were aristocratic literature, but they became popular later. Now, the word novel, which we find occurring in Spanish and in English in the course of the 16th century, or nouvelle, which in French meant short story, really. But of course, it's the word which means new. And it signals the notion that this is a new kind of literature. It's not the literature associated normally with the highest art. It's not quite popular literature in the sense of folklore and folk tales. It's somewhere in the middle. And Gogol understood this absolutely. He understood that between, on the one hand, the realistic novel as it had developed and which had created its own technique, that is, it focused on not the other world or the fantastic or the supernatural, but on the ordinary events of this world. So the character in the novel, as it develops in the course of the 18th century, first of all in England and then spreading elsewhere, character of the novel is to give us a world that is very much like our world. In the high genres, in comedy and tragedy, then the tragic character is far greater than we are, of higher rank, greater importance. The comic character is like us or worse than us, Aristotle says. But what the novel did was to take this comic character and elevate him, if not to tragic dimensions, at least to dimensions in the literary world of greater pretension. Suddenly, the comic character becomes more important. All right, so this divergence from the expected content of high art and official literature, it does have a great deal to do with folk culture. And Bakhtin speaks a great deal of that as well. Well, from Quixote through the 18th century to Jane Austen's one novel in which she adopts a kind of quixotic heroine, to Flaubert's Madame Bovary, to the Tatiana of Pushkin's Yevgeny Onyegin, you have young girls who live in a dream world constituted of their readings in novels. But not realistic novels, you see. And in this, we get this theme that Gogol treats in a very different way, the failure to distinguish fictional convention from actual social practice.
So the realist supposedly gives us actual social practice, and the romancer gives us fictional convention. You know, the heroine has to be the most beautiful who ever existed, and the hero has to be the most handsome and the greatest warrior that ever existed, and so on. So that world deals in superlatives. Well, Gogol saw the novel and the epic as merging in a new kind of literature, and he described it this way. He said, in the few past centuries, a new type of artistic composition has arisen, which, as it were, takes the middle road between the romance and the epic. The hero of this new genre is, although an isolated, insignificant figure, nevertheless meaningful in many respects for the observer of the human soul. The author leads this central figure through a connected series of adventures and changes in order to present, together with a true living picture of everything significant in the features and mores of the time he has selected, a mundane, almost statistically charted view of inadequacies, ill usage, sins, and all else that he has noted in the selected time period, the chrono, the tope of, trope of the chronotope, sorry, that is worthy of attracting the regard of any attentive contemporary seeking in the fabulous past living lessons for the present. It is too fixed, he says of the novel, as we have known it, is too fixed and static a form of composition. It also employs a strictly and calculatingly contrived beginning. All the characters whom it is intended to include in the action, or better, among whom the action must develop, must be taken up in advance by the author, who is necessarily preoccupied with the destiny of each of his characters. He is thus unable to push along and shift around these characters rapidly and in large quantities, as if they were fleeting phenomena. The advent of each character, at first apparently without any particular significance, is nevertheless a proclamation of his future participation in the novel's action. Everything is presented only through the necessity of its direct relation to the hero's destiny. And so he goes on to say that this is a defect. This kind of unity is a defect. It's an over-compressed interaction of characters. Everything, he says, that is not completely and immediately necessary is a defect in the novel and renders it prolix and dull. So this is not the episodic, you see. This is the tightly structured novel. But there's another kind, he says. This is the umbrella, you might say. And it is then governed for Gogol not by satire, but by laughter. And Bakhtin has a whole chapter in his book on Rabelais, and an article that he also published on Rabelais and Gogol, in which he talks about the history of laughter. So we'll continue with this next time. I want to point out, however, that there's, on page 8, there's just one thing I want to give you from the novel. He called his book a poema, a poem, meaning that he intended it in one sense, funny as this book is, to be an epic. Not a mock epic, not even a comic epic, but in a sense, a real epic, but a modern epic. And so he has epic similes. In the middle of that paragraph, that middle paragraph on page 8, when Chichikov enters the hall, everything was flooded with light. Everywhere one looked, black frock coats flitted and darted by singly and in clusters as flies dart over a white gleaming loaf of refined sugar in the summer season on a sultry July day, as an aged housekeeper standing in an open window cleaves and divides the loaf into glittering, curious, irregular lumps, all the children having flocked together are looking on, curiously watching the movement of her roughened hands as they lift up the maul, while the ethereal squadrons of flies, held up by the buoyant air, dart in boldly as if they own the whole place, and taking advantage of the crone's purblindness and of the sun that bothers her eyes,
bestrew the delectable morsels, in some places singly, in other places in thick clusters. Sated with the riches of summer, which spreads delectable repast at every step, even without such windfalls as this, they have flown in not at all in order to eat, but merely to show themselves. We suddenly realize this epic simile, you know, Homer has epic similes that run on for a while, but this one has gotten out of hand. It's created a whole separate world in great detail, but we can't tell where the simile stops and we get back to the gentleman in the black frock coats, because surely the flies aren't there simply to be seen. Suddenly the flies dissolve back into people, and we're suddenly aware of the fact that reality is one big simile. It is a literary construction. Well, we'll talk more about this next time.